Thousand Oaks is hanging there, Doc. I wish you'd get back to the pyramids. I'm working. That's where I'm going. I'm working my way back. I mean, there are lots of you that didn't mean a thing when we told you that the pyramid was lined up with Draco and the Pleiades. Now I can put it in perspective. And when I said the pyramid measured and conveys a full understanding of the precession of the equinoxes and is obviously built only by someone with full knowledge of the stars in those ancient days. Evolution says we begin as savages and get smart. We begin in the image of God and got dumb. That's the Christian premise. Now I'm in the business of proving the Bible. I wonder what the evolution is going to do with this one. Or I wonder what the racists are going to do. You think all black savages got educated by the slavers. Here's a tribe in Africa that knew. Arthur pointed out. Arthur Young had a particular passion for reading about mythologies from all over the world. One day he showed me a book entitled African Worlds, which contains several chapters. I'm reading from the Sirius Mystery, or the Sirius Mystery, or the Sirius Mystery. The Sirius Mystery. I just drive these astronomers crazy. One day he showed me a book entitled African Worlds, which contains several chapters, each dealing with a different tribe, with its views of life and its customs and mythology. There was a chapter about the Dogon, translated into English from the French, of Marcel Grial and Germain Dieterlen, the eminent anthropologist. Now, in this book, I happen to have a full translation of the French article about the Dogon. Let's keep going. Arthur pointed out to me a passage he had just read in this chapter, in which these famous anthropologists were describing the cosmological theories of the Dogon. I shall quote the paragraph. Quote, the starting point of creation, this is in their cosmology, revealed by their priests, like the sacred mysteries of the priests of the pyramid in Egypt, or like the sacred mysteries of the Druids among the Celts in ancient Britain, only to a trusted person that had been with them for years, as we'll see. This is what this tribe in Africa had in its cosmology. The starting point of creation is the star, which revolves around Sirius and is actually named the Digitaria star. It is regarded by the Dogon as the smallest and heaviest of all the stars. Now I'm going to get ahead of the story, but the problem with this is you can't see this star. And these people had no telescopes. And yet they regard, can you see these missionaries breaking out of the bush and the slavers breaking out of the bush finding these doggone people? And when you can get a priest to talk to you, he says, the starting point of creation is a star that revolves around the dog star that nobody can see. How do you know that? It is regarded by the Dogon as the smallest and heaviest of all the stars. It contains the germs of all things. Its movement on its own axes. Hey, the Pope is just about to admit that they may have been a little hard on poor old Galileo. This marvelous, wonderful Roman church in all of its brilliance in medieval Europe that's going to save Jerusalem from the heathen and colonize Africa. These doggone people not only are talking about the center of the creation being a star nobody can see, they have an awareness of it revolving on its own axes. How do you know that? It contains the germ of all things. Its movement on its own axes and around Sirius upholds all creation in space. Its orbit determines the calendar. That was all. That was all in that little article by Young. That's all. Just a tantalizing little dangler. There was no mention to the anthropologists of the actual existence of such a star. Now, Arthur Young and I both knew of the existence of the white dwarf star, Sirius B, which actually does orbit around Sirius, the dog star. How did they know that? Who would break out of the jungle? There's no missionary there teaching them. Now, they read this in that little old book entitled African World by these two anthropologists, and they're baited. Yet they know there is such a star, Sirius B. Now, in the cosmology of the Dogon, they said it was the smallest and heaviest of all stars. Now, Arthur Young and I knew that Sirius B was, quote, the smallest and heaviest type of star then known. Neutron stars and black holes have not yet been discovered. So we both naturally agreed that this was a most curious illusion from a supposedly primitive tribe. How could it be explained? I had let the matter drop due to other activities and concerns at that time, and approximately 2 years later in London, I suddenly was struck by the irresistible urge to investigate this question. I was prompted to do so by reading the rousing futuristic essays of Arthur C. Clarke, whom I had come to know by then. But this time I could not even remember the name of the African tribe, so I wrote to Arthur Young for it. He replied and kindly sent me a photostat of the entire chapter I had seen in African Worlds. So armed with the knowledge that it was a tribe called the Dogon that I was after, I bravely made my way to the Royal Anthropological Institute to see what I could find out about this peculiar tribe. The librarian went over the catalog listings with me, and I ran into a problem. Everything was in French, and I didn't know French. However, I persevered and found an article listed which included the word Sirius in its title. That looked promising. So I asked for a photostat, and when I picked this up a week or two later in November 1967, I was unable to make any sense of it, of course. So I eventually found someone to translate it for me in return for a fee. Finally, I was presented with the material in English. This article dealt exclusively with the most secret of all the traditions of the Dogon, which after years of living with them, the anthropologists Grial and Dieterlin had managed to extract from four of their head priests. After a special priestly conference among the tribe and a policy decision to make their secrets known, to Marcel Grial, the first outsider in their history to inspire their confidence. The most secret traditions of the Dogon all concern the star, which the Dogon call after the tiniest seed in grain known to them, the botanical name for which is Digitaria, but which is thus used in the article as the name of the star instead of the actual Dogon name, Pole. However, even in this article, which deals exclusively with this subject, the two anthropologists only mention the actual existence of a star which really exists and does what the Dogon say Digitaria does. They only mention it in a passing footnote in this brief remark, quote, "The question has not been solved nor even asked of how men with no instruments at their disposal could know the movements and certain characteristics of stars which are scarcely visible." Now, these are anthropologists asking the question. Even in saying this, the anthropologists were indicating their own lack of astronomical expertise, for the star Sirius B, which revolves around Sirius the dog star, is by no means scarcely visible. It's totally invisible. And was only discovered in the last century with the use of a telescope. And yet centuries and four centuries, the Dogon tribe have worshipped and seen this invisible star as the source of creation. It's totally invisible.
As Arthur Clark put it to me in a letter of 17th of July 1968, after he had suggested he would check the facts, quote, "By the way, Sirius B is about magnitude 8, quite invisible even if Sirius A didn't completely obliterate it." Only in 1970 was a photograph of Sirius B successfully taken by Irving Lindenblad of the U.S. Naval Observatory. This photograph is reproduced in Plate 1. You want to see it? Take your bets. You going to let me give them books or not? You going to let me give them books or not? That's not it. Zoom back in. That's not it. That's Sirius. That's the dog star. It's one of these little dots down in here. Underneath it, down in here. I'll take you that far. This is how bright Sirius A is. One of these little dots here, Sirius B, unable to be seen. This was taken by the U.S. Naval Observatory. No way those doggone people could have seen it with the natural eye, and yet. In the article which I obtained from the Royal Anthropological Institute, I sure fooled you, didn't I? Rial and Dieterlin recorded that the Dogon, that's this primitive tribe in Africa, said the star Digitaria, they call it Po, which is a grain that we don't have in our country, which is the smallest of all seeds of grain. So they called it that in order to convey the smallness of the star. How'd they know that? The Dogon said the star Digitaria, or Po, revolved around Sirius, every 50 years. They got a star they can't see, and they know that it revolves around Sirius every 50 years. And they're right. How do they know that? I mean, they never had any brains of some dumb honky got down there. That's why I hate racists. You know, why didn't those people that did Roots go find somebody like this to show off? If my black brothers had talked to me a little more, I'd tell them how to tell them honkies where to go. Think of this! That tribe in black Africa seeing a star that can't be seen, and telling you how many years it takes to revolve around Sirius. How'd they know that? Smart, that's why. Very smart. It didn't take me long to research Sirius B and discover that its orbital period around Sirius was indeed exactly 50 years. I now knew I was really onto something. And from that moment, I've been immersed in trying to get to the bottom of the mystery. Arthur Clark was extremely helpful during the next few months. I'm reading this so you'll know the guy that did this is not nuts. He wrote from Ceylon and was fairly often in London, so he and I have discussed at great length many of the mysterious facts from around the world which have since been given such public prominence by the Swiss-German author Erich von Däniken in his best-selling book, The Chariot of the Gods, and its sequels. Arthur Clark introduced me to one interesting professor after another, each with a pet mystery all his own. Me, I have a whole flock of pets. Derek Price, Avalon Professor of History of Science at Yale University, had discovered the true nature of the now famous mechanical computer of approximately 100 B.C. found in the Antikythera shipwreck at the turn of the century. Would you like to know about that? And unappreciated until it was dropped on the floor in Athens, cracked open, and they saw what it was. He also had found traces of Babylonian mathematics in New Guinea and talked a lot about the Raffles shipwreck. Then there was Dr. Alan McKay. This is my kind of guy. A crystallographer of Birkbeck College at the University of London who was interested in the Phaedos disk of Crete in a mysterious metal alloy found in a Chinese tomb and in the wilder stretches of the Oxus River. I found that with people like this around every corner, I was rapidly becoming distracted from my true quest by so many glittering riddles. Wouldn't I drive this guy nuts? I therefore abandoned all those mysteries and determined to concentrate in depth on cracking the one really hard and concrete puzzle that I'd been initially confronted with. How in the doggone heck did the doggone know such extraordinary things, and did it mean that the earth had been visited by extraterrestrials? I put an extra doggone or two in there. But how did they know this? Now, the trouble with trying to undertake a serious... Am I boring you? Trouble with trying to undertake a serious investigation about the possibility of extraterrestrial contact with Earth is that a lot of sensible people will be put off by the very idea. Then again, a lot of people who will enthusiastically receive my researches with open arms are the sort of people one least wants to be classed with. I have therefore undertaken all the work on this subject with a certain degree of reluctance. And if anyone pressed me during several years to say what I was doing, and they extricated from me the confession that I was working on a book, I didn't say what it was about, but merely mumbled, "Oh, God." But merely mumbled it was about the ancient Egyptians, or before that stage, about the mythology of some tribe in Africa. Not very interesting, really. This book will inevitably... I'll tell you what I'm going to show by this book, The Brotherhood of Man. With all the racism going on, if you're a Christian, you got to remember, we all sprang from the same father and mother. Now, God has made some choices en route, and to anybody unhappy with his choices, he's given us the best choice, to become one with him and his son, and receive the unmerited favor of the inheritance of grace. But the Bible keeps being proven, and I'll show you. This book will inevitably, I suppose, put me in that most unenviable category of those people who write about little green men from outer space. However, this is meant to be a serious inquiry. I'm tempted to apologize for the subject, but that would be pointless. Can it be that the Dogon came to realize something of the way in which people react to these things and keep it secret until the time came that truth would find a more ready receptivity? At least they came to realize something. Through some powerful instinct and after mutual consultation among the highest priests, they decided to take the unprecedented step of making public their highest mysteries. They trusted the French anthropologists. And when Marcel Grial died in 1956, to show their trust of this anthropologist, approximately 250,000 tribesmen massed for his funeral in Mali, in tribute to a man whom they revered as a great sage, equivalent to one of their own high priests. Such reverence must indicate an extraordinary man in whom the Dogon could believe implicitly. There is no question but that we are indebted to Marcel Grial's personal qualities for laying open the sacred Dogon traditions. I have now been able to trace these back to ancient Egypt, And they seem to reveal a contact in the distant past between our planet Earth and an advanced race of intelligent beings from another planetary system several light years away in space. It shouldn't surprise us. There must be other civilizations in our galaxy, other life. If you look up at the sky, the brightest star you can see is Sirius. You want to keep going? Venus and Jupiter are often brighter, but they're not stars. They're planets going around their own sun, which is a star itself. Now, no astronomer will tell you there's any particular reason for intelligent life to be anywhere in the area of Sirius. The reason Sirius is so bright is that it is large and close, bigger than the sun, bigger than the handful of other nearby stars. An intelligent astronomer will tell you that perhaps the stars Tau Ceti or Epsilon Eridani, which are rather similar to our sun, have planets with intelligent life. And that'd be a good guess. But among the stars most frequently discussed as possibly harboring intelligent life, Sirius is not included. Not an obvious choice. Now, Project OSMA took place in the spring of 1960. And in more recent years, other radio searches for intelligent life in space. Project OSMA sent out instrumentation and listened to these two stars, Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani, to see if any signals were coming from them on a certain wavelength at a certain time with a lot of energy behind them. Nothing happened. Later, such attempts have more realistically widened their scope somewhat, but the astronomers are fully aware that they're waltzing in the dark. Since Project OSMA, the giant radio telescope at Arecibo in Puerto Rico, which is, if not the largest now, was the largest in the world at this time, has listened selectively to several stars, but never listened to Sirius. It's just not the choice for life. Why are these doggone people focused in on it? Now, before we come to the evidence, I'd say a little more about Sirius. About the middle of last century, an astronomer was looking rather hard at Sirius over a period of time and got annoyed because it wouldn't sit still. It wobbled. He had a difficult time figuring this out. What made that star wobble? He finally concluded that an extremely, but unseen, heavy and massive star going around Sirius could make it wobble. He didn't see anything. The only trouble was there wasn't any large star going around Sirius. He couldn't see it. And when he finally looked and could see what was going around it, not with the natural eye, it wasn't a large star. It was a little bitty thing. A tiny little thing going around it every 50 years. So Sirius came to be called Sirius A, and the little bitty thing came to be called Sirius B. You bored? Now, Sirius B was at that time unique in the universe. For anyone knew, over 100 of these things have now been seen, scattered around the sky, and the many thousands more, which we can't see even though our modern telescopes look at them, or for them, because they're so tiny and their light's so feeble. They are called white dwarfs. Now, I'll tell you some details about it. A cubic foot of matter of Sirius B would weigh 2,000 tons. A matchbox full of matter from the star Sirius B would weigh a ton and a quarter. A matchbox full of its matter would weigh 2,500 pounds. Matchbox. How'd you like to pitch that over home plate? White dwarfs are strange because although they are feeble in light, they are very strong. They don't give out much light, but they are fantastically powerful gravitationally. Do you have any idea What a flying instrument with the power to break loose from that gravity could do in our atmosphere. Now, you saw those guys jump around on the moon where the gravitational power is a little different. Boy, they look like ballet dancers in all their funny suits that made Don Knotts almost have a heart attack. Remember Don Knotts in his spacesuit? Huh? Just think about that for a moment. A flying object, if there were intelligent beings on that white dwarf, don't anybody say I'm saying there are. Just speculate with me for a minute. Just fun night. And what else can we do while we're being interrupted with calls from the PTL satellite? Any anti-gravitational device, which is what a flying object is, our orbiting spaceship is an anti-gravitational device. It's kind of primitive. We're just barely able to get it out there and go around for 3 or 4 days. One capable of fighting gravity like this white dwarf that could spring free from it, do you have any idea what it could do in our gravitational field? They don't give out much light, but they're fantastically powerful gravitationally. On a white dwarf, we would not even be a fraction of an inch high. We would be flat, pulled in by gravity. You see, the big star that was necessary to make Sirius A wobble turned out to be a little thing, but it still had to be as massive and heavy as an ordinary star of much more enormous size. It is, in short, a star so dense and closely packed that it is not even made out of regular matter. It is made out of what is called degenerate matter or super dense matter, where the atoms are pressed together and the electrons squashed. This matter is so heavy that it cannot be thought of in any familiar terms. There is nothing in our solar system, to our knowledge, comparable to this stuff.
This is the end of Side 1.